From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by the Interventional Institute at Holy Name Hospital, offering non-surgical treatment options for people with inoperable or chronic conditions such as cancer, peripheral artery disease, uterine fibroids, and varicose veins. More at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Arab-Israeli conflict surely is one of the most covered, hardest to cover stories of all time. News consumers, especially in America, often believe they already know this story. They know in each instance where wrong was committed, where justice was done. But responsible reporters aren't supposed to bring unbreakable assumptions into the field. So this week I'm reporting from Jerusalem to learn how local reporters on both sides of the divide cover themselves and each other. First stop, the city of Ramallah, seat of the Palestinian Authority. We've come to see Wafa Abdel Rahman, whose new media organization Philistiniat monitored the Palestinian media during the last election.
The first problem that the journalists here face is their own self-censorship, where they draw lines. It's deep-rooted when it comes to the Palestinian media.
At first, those lines were drawn by the Israeli military censors who once reviewed all their work. But after the Oslo Accords of 1993, those censors packed up and left the West Bank, leaving the Palestinian Authority, run by Yasser Arafat's Fatah party, in charge.
When the Palestinian Authority came, they came from an Arab culture where the Arab regimes are doing the censorship. So, of course, they almost copied the Arab regimes here.
Currently, there are more than 60 local radio and TV stations in the Palestinian territories. The newspapers aren't widely read. During the past parliamentary campaign, most of the Palestinian media overcovered Fatah candidates, says Abdel Rahman. But that doesn't seem to have hurt the newly elected Hamas party, a group known for good works in the PA and suicide bombings in Israel.
Actually, this raised the question, is our media influential or not? I would say the most effective way to influence Palestinian public opinion is word of mouth.
The second most effective way, she concedes, is through the widely watched Arabic language satellite channels, first among them, Al Jazeera.
More than 67% of the Palestinians, they prefer to watch news through Al Jazeera compared with other channels.
Walid Al-Amari is Al Jazeera's bureau chief in Israel and the Palestinian Authority, based in East Jerusalem. In the dark days of Fatah, he says he was frequently harassed when he reported on human rights violations or corruption within the PA. But when Fatah weakened, the power of the press grew. Now he says it's the freest in the Middle East, a reality Hamas has to confront one way or the other.
Even the people inside the Palestinian Authority, they understand very well the freedom of the media. And if they want us to cover the confrontation with the Israelis and with the Israeli occupation, they must understand that we have also to cover the confrontations and the problems inside the Palestinian society.
There was a time when the PA and its media stood arm in arm. The time of what's called the Second Intifada, initiated in a wave of violent protests in September of 2000 in the Old City of Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza, followed by widespread demonstrations, clashes with Israeli military, attacks on Israeli civilians, and targeted killings of Hamas leaders and other Palestinians.
During the Intifada under Yasser Arafat, there were almost no pressure on how the media covered the story.
Khalid Abu Akar is a Palestinian journalist who edits an Arabic language website and reports for the New York Times.
The Second Intifada created a situation where journalists from the two sides stood next to the fighters. Whether it is the Palestinian journalists who stood next to their own fighters or the Israeli journalists who stood next to their own soldiers, as if they were part of that war.
I used to serve in the army for 1 month a year, I could not be a journalist 11 months a year and 1 month not be a journalist.
Daniel Ben-Simon is a columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, widely regarded as Israel's best reported paper, despite being left of center. He says the Second Intifada, which brought the fight over occupation to Israeli doorsteps, engendered a kind of post-traumatic stress in the public and the media.
1,100 dead, 80% women and children died in the most horrible ways. You cannot play the independent journalist. My paper, I remember that Zev Schiff was the chief commentator. He wrote, now it's time to retaliate and to kill as many as we can. I said, Zev, how could you write something like this? He said, I was a kid, an orphan in Belgium in the times of the Holocaust. And this is exactly 70 years later, I'm back there. And I feel the same helplessness. Now, he's the chief commentator. He's a very smart guy, but he lost it.
Ben-Simon says that Israeli journalists, once brash enough to bring down governments, were slammed by the public when they raised questions about leaders, as when Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was running for office.
The first time, in 2001, he was accused of corruption. Haaretz came up with the big headlines about corruption of the prime minister, that he will be indicted. We thought that our paper was doing the right thing. We lost hundreds of subscribers. Not only that, but Sharon added another 5 points.
As prime minister, Sharon left the right-wing Likud party to form Kadima, a centrist party that would carry out his plan for disengagement. Then he suffered a massive stroke and fell into a coma, leaving the unknown and untried Kadima in charge.
And suddenly, we have something which stands in total contrast to the character of the people. A party with no elections, which was formed in dark rooms. I'm ashamed, and as an Israeli who is used to people who are debating, but suddenly we are tired of politics.
There's no real left in Israel now. There's no real right wing in Israel now. Everybody wants to be center, and it's boring.
Razi Berkai is the host of a leading political talk show on Army Radio. He says the media played a part in that drift toward a fuzzy, amorphous middle.
Because it's not a secret that most of Israeli journalists came from the left, what you call in the States liberals, okay? But I think Israeli journalists have lost their romantic view towards an agreement with Palestinians. Israelis are tired. They are tired of Palestinians. They are tired of Jewish inhabitants in Gaza and the West Bank.
The settlers.
Right, the settlers. People got fed up. And ideology has become something irrelevant.
Amnon Lord is editor of the rightist weekly Makor Rishon. A former lefty turned righty, he says, after he realized the Oslo Accords would not lead to peace. He says the media have been happy to follow Sharon's lead in ignoring or demeaning the settlers. Take the demonstration just this week in Jerusalem in support of settlers who clashed with Israeli defense forces in the settlement of Amona. The two largest papers, he says, buried it. Only Haaretz, to which he doesn't even subscribe, paid attention.
There was a special report about the moderates among the settlers, how they felt betrayed by the way the evacuation of Amona was carried out. And in a way, yes, I think that Haaretz, who's extreme leftist, also keeps, I think, a higher standard of journalism, which enables them to show other sides of the settlers.
For many years, Gidon Levy has covered the misery of the occupation for Haaretz. As a result, he is widely hated by the right. But he sees their point about the settlers.
The pioneers of yesterday are the criminals of today. And you can see it in the media from left to right. If there is something like this, all of a sudden, the settlers are the big enemy.
But if increasingly centrist Israelis are indifferent to the settlers, Levy says they're increasingly indifferent to their own sufferings, too.
They deal with it now in different ways than 5 years ago, when it was for 3 days of mourning and different music. And today, there's an explosion, 5, 10, 15 people are killed, 2, 3 hours of reports. And here we are with the next subject.
He says the average Israeli is an avid media consumer, but...
Does he really know what's going on in the dark backyard of this state, namely in the occupied territories? My answer is no.
Does he want to know?
No, he doesn't want to know. The journalist doesn't want to write, and the editor doesn't want to publish, and the publisher doesn't want it to be published, and the government doesn't want it to be published. It's a rare coalition from wall to wall almost, in which nobody wants to inform and nobody wants to be informed, which enable such a brutal occupation to exist for so many years without really bothering the Israelis, which on their behalf all this is happening.
Palestinian journalist Khalid Abu Akar says his people don't have that luxury.
You cannot say, oh, we are fed up. We know that our lives are controlled by Israel. If someone want to travel outside his city, need to go through an Israeli checkpoint. If Palestinians need fuel, it should come from Israel. If they want food or vegetables, it should come from Israel. So every Palestinian know that their lives depend on Israel. And therefore, the interest in what's going on in Israel will continue. They don't close their eyes and pretend they don't see the Israelis. They see them every day.
Unfortunately, these days, mostly all they see are settlers and soldiers. But as a journalist who trains journalists, he sees more than that. He sees something to aspire to in the famously adversarial Israeli press, even if it is in momentary retrenchment.
If you were to direct the journalist that you're training towards a news outlet that you think has it just right, what would that news outlet be?
You know, Al Jazeera is a good example. Israeli press is another example. Many people won't like using that example, but the Israeli media managed to pressure politicians and mainly prime ministers to resign or to put them on trial. This is what I want to see in the Palestinian press. When I look at the Israeli media and see how Israeli politicians are accountable, I feel jealous. And I keep dreaming of having a situation where we'll be almost similar.
For On the Media, this is Brooke Gladstone in Jerusalem.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. Brooke is reporting this week from Israel and the West Bank. I'm Bob Garfield. With the world's focus in recent days on the violent reaction to a Danish political cartoon, it's more obvious than ever how complex and treacherous is the practice of journalism about the Middle East. We're devoting our entire show to the subject as we attempt to peel away at least a few layers of a story often portrayed in simplistic terms. But no matter how many layers deep you go, the core remains the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, where nothing is simple, not even a common noun.
Often on this program, we examine words that take on new meanings or resonance in response to certain events. It's a feature we call Word Watch. And in and around the West Bank, Israel is currently constructing, let's call it a barrier, that goes by many names, depending on who's doing the naming.
In fact, the problem is that in some places it's a fence, and in some places it's a wall, in some places it's electronic sensors, in some places it's guard posts.
Ethan Bronner reported on the Arab-Israeli conflict for many years. Now he's deputy foreign editor for the New York Times. Before I left for Israel, he told me that many places and events bear significantly different labels on each side of the divide.
For example, what the Jews and Israel call the Six-Day War, the Arabs and Palestinians call the 1967 Middle East War. What the Jews and Israelis call the Yom Kippur War, the Arabs call the October War of 1973. When we talk about what the Jews call the Temple Mount, we say something like what Israelis and Jews call the Temple Mount and what the Muslims call the Haram al-Sharif, the Holy Sanctuary.
In July of 2003, New York Times reporter James Bennett wrote a memo from Israel to his editors, noting that the barrier was becoming, quote, the latest linguistic dividing line in the conflict. He said he'd received several ferocious emails after a Times headline referred to it as a border fence, which he wrote, it definitely is not. There is no border, though Palestinians argue that the fence is intended to define one. He said it would also be a mistake to call it a security fence because that would be taking a side by accepting Israel's definition of what it's holy for. Palestinians, he noted, call it a land grab because it follows a route that goes past the line that defined Israel before 1967. Palestinians prefer the word wall because it invokes Berlin and prison. Bennett suggested barrier is the most neutral term, and that's pretty much what the Times decided. Ethan Bronner.
Sometimes we begin it by calling it a separation barrier because we feel that that is a legitimate phrase, that it is to separate Israelis from Palestinians.
He says the phrase implies no comment on the barrier's real or suggested purposes, but notes that for many readers, neutrality holds no appeal.
The word barrier doesn't so much anger people, but the failure to call it something else does seem to bother people, particularly from the left, the failure to call it a wall. I can tell you that I was giving a talk once to a group of conservative Jewish listeners in the United States, and I laid this whole thing out explaining, well, the Israelis like to call it a fence, the Palestinians like to call it a wall, and we've selected the word barrier because it's a neutral term that doesn't pass judgment. And then I was talking to a lady afterwards, and I used the word barrier, and she starts punching me sort of with her finger into my chest and saying, fence, you're talking to a fence person now. Call it a fence.
When defense became an important subject in the media, we noticed that everyone refers to it as a wall, when only 5% of it is a concrete wall and the rest is actually a fence.
David Saranga currently works in the Israeli consulate in New York, but prior to that, in Israel, he coordinated the public relations effort for the barrier. He says it's very important to find the right words.
So we started to use the term the anti-terrorist fence or the security fence, in order to make the world understand what is the reason Israel is building a fence. It's not about separation. It's about preventing the terror to enter Israel.
As a practical matter, what does a fence look like in this context?
A fence look like something which is reversible. I mean, if you build a wall, so it's irreversible. But if you build a fence, this means that it's something you can move. It's something you can change its route.
Saranga suggests suicide bombings have decreased because of the barrier, which, according to the Israeli consulate in New York, eventually will be roughly 312 miles long. But though it is mostly not a wall, he says a wall is what most of us see.
If you search for images of the fence in Google or in the news agency's websites, you will only see wall pictures, no fence. And the question is why? The answer is very simple, because it makes a more dramatic picture of the fence.
But you will admit that those pictures are pretty dramatic because that is one heck of a wall.
No doubts. But on the other hand, if we want to bring the accurate information so people should understand that it's only 5% of the whole picture.
the wall, the place where it is a wall, it's about 70 feet high. Why so high and so solid in certain places?
Because there are certain places where the purpose of the wall is to prevent the Palestinians to shoot on vehicles on the Israeli side. In some places, the Israeli cities are so close to the Palestinian cities or villages, so in order to prevent those shootings, we had to build a wall.
The Palestinian village of Beilein is located roughly 3 miles outside the so-called Green Line of 1967. Nearby, also outside the line, is the Israeli settlement of Modin Elite. The barrier is set to run between them, cutting off a big chunk of Beilein. Every Friday for the past year, Palestinian and Israeli activists gather at the house of a Palestinian member of the Committee Against the Wall and the Settlements before trudging up to the site for a nonviolent protest. February 3rd was a particularly lousy Friday. Rain, then hail.
My name is Ratib Abu Rahma, member of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and the Settlement. I am 40 years old. I am a teacher in a university.
It's his house, now sheltering a couple dozen young Israelis with mud-caked shoes, waiting for their Palestinian counterparts to finish their mid-morning prayers at a nearby mosque.
The wall here in our village is stolen more than 60% of our land. This wall is stolen land, not for security wall. Beilein is peaceful. And in our village, before more than 30 years ago, there isn't any persons do anything against Israel.
Given Beilein's peaceful history, he objects to the word security. Fellow committee member Mohammed Khatib objects to the word fence.
Fence, you can see the other side, but here you cannot see the other side. It's a wall, not a fence. Here we are together, Israelis and the Palestinians are fighting to see each other. We want to see each other.
I think the implications of this barrier and the political significance behind it can only be conveyed by the term wall.
Jonathan Pollack is an Israeli member of a group called Anarchists Against the Wall.
This is not a picket fence between one neighbor's garden and the other neighbor. We're talking about a barrier that completely disrupts ordinary life of ordinary people.
For Israeli activist Itai Valdi, the word barrier also falls short.
Barrier, I think it's a bit misleading because you have some notion that it can be removed easily. And this fence cannot be moved unless there's taken a very strong action by the state. It cannot be moved by the people on the ground.
Most of the demonstrators here say they would be able to accept the wall if it ran along the Green Line, but it cuts into villages like Beilein to accommodate Israeli settlements. As the protesters head up to the site, clambering in the mud over rocks, a dozen armed Israeli soldiers of roughly the same age or younger come running down from the rise, over which stand the half-built houses of the expanding settlement of Modin Elite. I look in vain for the barrier, but there isn't one. It's just a void, a muddy path, now lined with soldiers on one side and protesters on the other. There's some jeering, some pushing, some chanting in Hebrew and English and Arabic, and then it's over. A week ago at the Israeli consulate, I asked David Saranga if there was any way to win the war of words.
I think it is impossible to win that war. What is possible is to sit, to negotiate, to hear the other's opinion, to hear what the Palestinians are using, which words they are using. We want the Palestinians to hear what we have to say. So the only solution to win that war of words is to sit and to talk.
There was a lot of talk in Beilein from students, academics, villagers, and anarchists. But for the Israeli media and the Israeli public, the argument over words is largely settled. Whether they call it a wall, a fence, or a barrier, they believe it is a security measure and it will save lives. For many Palestinians, it's a question of land and law, and they've taken their challenges to court. For them, as for the Israelis, the words in this war of words are really beside the point.
If the recent democratic ascendancy of Hamas weren't enough evidence, then the proof came this week. After days of violent protests over provocative political cartoons, the familiar phrase kept roaring back.
Welcome back to Hardball. Is this cartoon violence just the latest chapter in a global clash of civilizations?
Osama bin Laden has said that he wants a clash of civilizations.
All of Europe is now talking about a clash of civilizations.
If it is a clash we're talking about, you might say that Assad Abu Khalil is watching it play out from both sides. With two satellite dishes, seven or eight Arabic language newspapers, and a number of internet magazines, Abu Khalil is awash in media from the Middle East, from his home in California. A native of Lebanon, Abu Khalil teaches political science at Cal State Stanislaus. He knows more acutely than most what our respective media are saying, and he joins me now for some analysis. Assad, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Taking the Arab media in aggregate, and I understand this requires some generalization, what did they get most wrong when covering the United States?
That's a very good question. It's not that you find a lot of attention to the bad, sensational stories in the United States. Some Arab nationalists, like the Iraqi Ba'ath Party, which is now defunct, used to do a lot of that kind of coverage that you used to see in the Soviet newspapers during the Cold War. You know, attention to crime and prostitution and things of that nature. That is now scant in the Arab media. But there is another problem, which is this. Because there is such close affinity between many Arab governments and the United States, the coverage, perhaps to your surprise, is largely sympathetic to the administration in power. The United States makes sure, given that most Arab media are controlled by the Saudi royal family, that the coverage in no way hurts its image among Arab people. And because the United States failed miserably in making a success out of the taxpayers-funded propaganda TV called Al-Hurra TV, there is now much more reliance by the administration on Saudi-funded networks, especially Al-Arabiya TV, which is a main rival for Al Jazeera. And there is a reluctance on the part of these media to be independent. I'm not saying critical, but independent of the agenda of the administration.
Well, let's look at the current controversy over the Danish cartoons that were perceived to be blasphemies and insults to Islam. To what extent are Arab media fanning the flames, and to what extent are they trying to put it in perspective of, you know, the sort of secular notion of a free press completely separate from government?
There is no question that the media, at the behest of the government, are encouraging the story to perpetuate, especially when they know the public is very angry about Israel and the United States. But, you know, the government wouldn't dare upset those two. So let us now upset and provoke Denmark and Norway. On the other hand, to be fair, most of them do quote and interview individuals and clerks who tend to insist to their viewer that protests should be peaceful and democratic and it shouldn't spill over into violence against places of worship as in Lebanon or against even embassies and so on.
We've often heard it said over the last few days that the teeming Arab street simply cannot grasp the concept that what a single Danish newspaper does not speak for the sentiments of the Danish government or even the entire Western world. Is it true that the Arab world is so accustomed to state-controlled media that it just doesn't understand the separation of press and state?
Oh, no, that's absolutely not true. That's a misrepresentation of Arab public opinion, which is much more sophisticated, even though we pejoratively here still refer to it as a street for reasons that are not clear to me. People are aware, by and large, of the democratic nature of governments, but they are also very aware of something that you and I know, which is there are no absolute freedoms of expressions, whether here or there in Europe. They are very aware that there are limits, sometimes legal and sometimes self-exercised by media in order not to offend sensibilities of various groups. But when there is a tendency to mock one religion and then you express extreme respect for other religion, there is more than a tinge of bigotry that is being manifested, and that's what people in the region are looking at. We should also underline that the government of Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Syria and Iran are in no position to offer lectures to anybody about what is offensive and what is not, given a very atrocious record by the media of those governments, whether it's anti-Semitic articles or cartoons or whatever else.
All right, let's flip the question around. I want to ask you about our media, I should say Western media. Do you think that the Western press in general does a pretty good job in understanding the dynamics of the Arab political world?
Well, I find a huge difference between European media and between the American media on the coverage of the Middle East. I mean, I can think of very few, if any, American journalists who deliver the news from the Middle East to us here, whether in visual media or print media, who really know Arabic or Hebrew or Persian or Turkish. That is not the case in European media, and it shows. You find a much more in-depth understanding and nuances of politics and society that is missing from the American media. In America, we're accustomed to a correspondent who stays like 3 weeks in Lebanon, and then the person is back in Washington, D.C., and he may be covering, or she may be covering Michael Jackson, and then we send them to Germany and then to Iraq. I mean, it's a mess.
Well, given the demagogic tendencies of government, as we're witnessing in the current crisis, have the media done their job in the Arab world, or is there some culpability in the Arab media for not shedding the light of truth and perspective on the situation?
No, I would definitely give very low marks to the Arab media over the last several weeks, including Al Jazeera TV, which I think usually is much better than the rest. I think they have given way too much attention, way too much coverage to the story of the cartoons. I mean, people are entitled to their own outrages. Perhaps it's my own biases here, and this issue doesn't rank high on my long list of outrages. I would say that what's happening in Darfur in the Sudan and what's happening to the Palestinians should rank much higher as an outrage and as a news story than those 12 cartoons in some Danish newspapers. And it seems to me in that respect, the Arab media failed.
All right. Well, Assad, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Assad Abu Khalil is a professor of political science at Cal State Stanislaus. He is the author of The Battle for Saudi Arabia from Seven Stories Press. And he blogs at angryarab.blogspot.com. Coming up after the break, more on the cartoon controversy. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
We're back with our special Middle East broadcast of On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The New York Press is an alternative weekly in New York City with a circulation of about 116,000. Not big by newspaper standards, but this week the paper made big headlines when three of its top editors and a reporter abruptly quit after the owner refused to publish the infamous Danish Muhammad caricatures. In a statement, management said the images, quote, were not critical for the editorial content to have merit and only served to further fan the flame of a volatile situation. The same rationale has been invoked by most American news organizations this week. Only two major dailies and a few smaller papers have reprinted the images. But Tim Marchman, New York Press managing editor, make that former managing editor, says it wouldn't have been enough to simply describe the offensive cartoons.
I think there are two reasons why not. First, I think that the reason most outlets have not run this is the threat of violence. And I think that there was an obligation for the press to run these images to show that violence will not carry a veto over images that run in Western newspapers. Secondarily, I think the press needs to run these images because of a very curious argument that I've heard, which is that the description of the images suffices because readers can go to the internet to find the images. It's obscene for any newspaper man to say that, to say that a newspaper's coverage doesn't need to be substantially complete in its own right. It's farcical.
But is there no cartoon or caricature that would cross the line for you? I mean, where is your line where the issues of offensiveness trump that of, you know, delivery of news and information?
I don't know where that line is. I'm a free speech absolutist, and I don't think that there is any image too grotesque or offensive to some people for it to be indefensible to run it.
Lynching cartoons? Holocaust cartoons?
No, I absolutely support the right of newspapers to run these images. If those are met with criticisms from fellow members of the press, from the public, boycotts, you know, revocation of advertising dollars, that's entirely appropriate.
If Marchman's move was extreme, it was still in keeping with this country's basic journalistic values. But in Europe, where the cartoons originated, free speech absolutists have a harder time making their case. That's because in the aftermath of World War II, many European nations passed laws banning racist speech, Holocaust denial, and incitement. Laws which set a precedent, says University of Michigan visiting law professor David Bernstein, a precedent for further restrictions down the road by other aggrieved groups.
Incitement basically means that you encourage people to engage in illegal acts. There's just the case in England, actually, where an imam of a mosque was charged with incitement and convicted because he had urged his followers to kill specific groups that are not Muslims. In Europe, if you encourage people to commit violence and they do it, even if you can't trace the violence directly to the person who made the statement, you could be charged. Now, in the United States, this would be protected by the First Amendment because unless you could show a very direct relationship between the speech, in other words, someone actually saying, get that person over there, and the action, it would be protected. Hate speech basically is just defined as the kind of speech that will tend to lead people to want to engage in negative action against a minority group. So if you publish a controversial scientific study, say, on race and intelligence, that would not be considered hate speech unless it was your intent to try to denigrate the group that was shown to have lower intelligence.
Now, you have asserted, this is not settled law in the United States, that under the right political circumstances, the U.S. Congress could enact laws that do encroach on First Amendment rights. Tell me that scenario.
It's a very fragile consensus that we have in the legal community in favor of strong protections for freedom of speech. And this consensus is only 50 years old, maybe. And we used to have rather strict libel laws in the United States that really inhibited people from saying nasty things. We used to have group libel laws even, limited what you could say about particular groups. We used to have blasphemy laws that prohibited taking the Lord's name in vain. In this country, we don't have formal speech restrictions, but we do, to some extent, allow political correctness to be codified in the law and required in the workplace and in schools through university speech codes, even in state universities. There's a lot of controversy over that. Liberals who used to be the strongest supporters of freedom of speech have taken a step back, and a very large percentage of the law professors who teach constitutional law now believe that some sorts of hate speech restrictions are constitutional. We haven't really seen this affecting the law so much because, first of all, we have a lot of Reagan and Bush appointees on the federal courts. Even with Bill Clinton, he was appointing people who went to law school in the 50s, 60s. I wonder what will happen, though, in 20 or 30 or 40 years if you have liberal presidents in power and the next generation of lawyers making the law have grown up in an era where they're taught that we should have more restrictions on freedom of speech. But I think the Muhammad cartoon controversy shows the dangers of looking at things from only the alleged victim's perspective. Almost inevitably, someone is going to be offended by almost anything anyone can say that's critical. What we should be aiming for is a situation where we require people basically to tolerate things that offend them.
Okay, David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Bernstein is author of You Can't Say That, The Growing Threat to Civil Liberties from Anti-Discrimination Laws. The question of limits to free speech, what they should be and whether they should exist at all, has been a constant theme in the week's cartoon coverage. But in making the story mainly about free speech, do the American media end up casting the world's Muslims as freedom-hating fanatics? Middle East historian and blogger Juan Cole thinks so, and he says there's a better way of understanding what's going on. It's less about religion, he wrote this week in Salon, than about religious nationalism and the specific power struggles taking place in each country.
The story is the ways in which this controversy has been used within Middle Eastern societies. I think a lot of the more secular-minded and liberal groups have been the most vocal in denouncing the caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad because it's an easy way of bolstering their own Islamic credentials, and it's cost-free. Look at who has been most vocal all along since last fall on these caricatures. It's been the foreign minister of Egypt, representative of a secular military regime, which is, in fact, under a lot of pressure from the fundamentalist Muslim Brotherhood. Or you look at the most violent incidents were in the secular cities of Damascus and Beirut, not known for their Islamic fundamentalism.
Understood, but before we entirely dismiss the notion of widespread fanaticism, these incitements, cynical though they may have been, nonetheless, you know, got hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Beirut chanting against Denmark and so forth. In other words, it wasn't hard for them to get traction. There must be something going on there.
Well, yes, but the question is what exactly is going on? And one thing that should be underlined is that it's widely thought that the mere depiction of the Prophet Muhammad is somehow being objected to. I don't think most Muslims care too much if the Danes want to draw pictures of the Prophet Muhammad. And indeed, there's a famous issue of the French adventure magazine Tintin with the Prophet's picture on the front. Nobody ever made a big deal out of that. The issue is really more a kind of racist depiction of the Prophet Muhammad. You know, we in America don't have a strong sense of European colonialism, but most Muslim countries have been ruled for much of the last 200 years by Europeans. And while the Europeans were ruling places like Algeria, they weren't nice to Islam or Muslims. And they had a racist discourse about it. They depicted Semites as fanatical, as violent, as irrational, and therefore as needing European rule. So to take the Prophet Muhammad and to depict him with a large nose and a bomb in his turban, it's a continuation of those exact same anti-Semitic and racist themes that have been characteristic of European colonial discourse for 150 years. This is not something new, and people in the Middle East are tired of it.
Well, if it's true that this whole conflict has been portrayed in simplistic and maybe dangerous ways, who's most at fault? Is it the American media? Is it the Arab media? Is it the Arab politicians who have waved the cartoons, the real ones and then fake ones as well, in the face of their constituencies? Clerics? Who?
Well, the entire episode has been full of demagoguery, and demagogues always feel that they benefit from these public displays. So everybody's seeing what they can get out of it. The American believers in a war on terror have another stick with which to beat Muslims. The Hezbollah in southern Lebanon suddenly has an issue to mobilize people on the streets in Beirut. The Egyptian secular foreign minister now can boast of his Islamic credentials. A secular Pakistani party like the PPP can denounce Denmark, but at the same time introduce a resolution to repeal Islamic law. So everybody's getting something out of this, which is why it's such a big hullabaloo.
All right, Juan. Well, as always, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Juan Cole teaches modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and blogs at onecole.com.
Israel has a history of sharp political satire, and the latest in those annals is Eretz Nehederet, or Wonderful Country, launched in 2003 on Friday nights. A combination of Saturday Night Live and The Daily Show, it's the nation's leading water cooler program and its primary source of fake news. Not shrinking from satirical takes on past assassinations, as of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, or future ones of, say, Ariel Sharon. Already the show has been threatened by at least one angry terrorist. Perhaps that was inevitable for A Wonderful Country. I was joined in Tel Aviv this week by three of its writers, Omri Marcus, Avi Ettinger, and Asaf Weiser. You guys focus on satirizing the news on the program. That's your principal beat. You have a prime minister who's incapacitated. You have Hamas elevated to the leadership of the Palestinian Authority. I mean, did you wake up that day and go, wow, this is great? Or did you go, geez, how am I supposed to deal with this stuff?
I can say first of for myself that in those two events that you've mentioned, the first thing I thought about was where my country is going, and the second was, oh my God, it's hilarious for both of them. No, maybe not for both of them, because with the Prime Minister, you know, it took us a little time to understand what is the condition and what is going on. But the Hamas taking the leadership of the occupied territories, the first thing was maybe a bit of fear, but as I said, the second thing we thought about was that's an excellent material for satire.
Sharon was, it was a tricky situation because the whole country was depressed for about 10 days when he wasn't sure if he was going to die or if he was going to come out of it. So we made a show and we decided not to laugh about the prime minister himself, but about to mock the media coverage of everything, because we had like 48 hours newscasts, and every 5 minutes they'd update the situation on Sharon, and just the same guy, the same doctor would come out and say that nothing's changed, and he would look rumpled already. So
the news update was the rerun of the last new update.
Avi, tell me how you dealt with Hamas.
Well, there's this guy, number two in Hamas, who looks like a carrot top, but he has an orange beard, which it's artificial, he dyes it. And so we like made him like he's this sort of clubber type, like he's going, Hamas is going into different directions, they're going into house music.
Excuse me, but I find it hard to believe that Hamas has changed its ways overnight.
Not Hamas, Ham House. Here's a flyer for the party.
But Mahmoud, this flyer calls for the execution of collaborators.
Oh, that's leftover from before. Flip it over.
Ah, I see. The party's Thursday at 9.
I think we are most of the time quite surprised from the impact that there is for the show. Number two in the Hamas with the carrot beer was interviewed after the show about the situation in the Middle East, and most of the interview he decided to speak about his character and Wonderful Country and how it insulted him and how it's not okay to do it and no one asked for his permission, and suddenly he sounded like some strange guy that care more about his way of appearance in Wonderful Country than about the occupation of the West Bank.
Is there any item on the program, anywhere on the program, whether or not you guys wrote it yourselves, that you think went a little over the top?
Okay, about a year ago, they decided to make a musical about the Yitzhak Rabin, including the assassination, I think. Yeah. I didn't see it. And a lot of people thought, this is sick. Why do you want to make a musical? I mean, no. So the first gag that opened this third season was a musical about Rabin's assassin, Yigal Amir.
10 years have passed. Where were you on the day that changed the country? Where will you be in a week?
The One Who Shot. A major production brought to you by Amir's family, the Nationalistic Theater, and 20% of the citizens of Israel. Come and see the life story of the hero who redeemed Israel.
That was very controversial. Yeah. A lot of viewers were saying, "Whoa, that's."
This time ago.
But when you saw it on TV, did you think it was funny?
It was hilarious.
He says quietly and confidently. Didn't you a year ago or so have a kind of Ariel Sharon death watch? Yeah. What was that about?
I think the atmosphere was that there were segments in the Israeli public that thought it was legitimate to assassinate Sharon. And since we've already had one assassination, we were like, preparing for the next one. That was the sketch.
What does it do to humor when you become so important that you have the ability to increase the profile of a candidate?
I think it's on the contrary. I think we can only decrease the popularity of a candidate. We can't increase anything like that.
But Omri, I've been told that it's a real compliment to be made fun of on the program. An Israeli government official told me that.
Yeah, it's like the coronation process for a public figure.
But you don't find that that kind of power a little paralyzing when it comes to making jokes, or does it just make you drunk with power?
It's not paralyzing, but I believe that in everything in life, with power comes responsibility. You can't...
Are you Spider-Man now? With power comes responsibility? Go on.
Yeah, exactly like Spider-Man. Many times we can hurt people with jokes. Do they deserve it in any way? You have to ask yourself this question, I think. That's what I mean talking about responsibility.
I don't think... If you try to think of it consciously, it'll paralyze you. I think you shouldn't block yourself and you should just write anything that comes to mind. And then there's an editor. That's his job to say, no, we can't really say this on the show.
I think there are so many blood, sweat, and tears involved in writing a joke that all the stuff of message and responsibility, if we have a good joke, we'll tell it. We don't care.
All right. Asaf Beiser, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Omri Marcus, thanks to you.
Thank you, T.
And Avi Ettinger, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
These are the three writers who write the weekly updates for the program Eretz Nehederet, Wonderful Country.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and this week he was Brooks' producer in Israel. Jennifer Munson is our engineer and had help this week from Rob Christensen. We also had help from Mark Phillips and Ani Katz. A special thanks to Aya Keefe. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back in the States next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. On the web at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org. And thanks.